October 9th, 2021. It is Coffee with Crime. I'm Lewis.
And I'm Alexi.
And we're back.
That's right. It's been a little while.
It has. But so we appreciate people sticking with us as the intervals between episodes have become obviously larger. But let's get right into it because this is kind of the reason that we're doing this is really because of the coffee that we're doing today. Someone sent me a message, I believe, over Facebook Messenger not too long ago. His name is Ben Herman. And he said, I think I've seen him once or twice at concerts and stuff, but he said, hey, I am part of a company that's growing a Colombian coffee roasting company, and would you be willing to promote, not promote, but just like try our coffees on your podcast?
So he came to you and asked you this?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's
really cool.
So they sent us some coffee. This is a very international sort of thing. It's very unique in a lot of ways. There are a lot of people involved. Let me show you on the screen here. So this is Ben who reached out to me.
Oh, nice.
Screaming at the top of a mountain out of pure joy. And this is Braden, the design and branding guy. This over here is the founder. His name is, I think probably in Spanish, it's Erfin. And I'm going to tell you about him in a second. But then this guy I recognize, Travis Meyer.
He
is working with multimedia and content, and he's part of the team too. So we both know Travis through Alexi's sister Katrina. Travis used to work at WQAD in the news station in Moline. So the founder, it says Erfin Liz is a NASA native from the Togoima Reservation in the south of Colombia. He grew up on his parents' coffee farm. When he was 16, he left the country to study in Norway and then in the U.S. After completing college in Iowa, he founded the Colombian Coffee Connection, which now has been rebranded to Native Root. So this is the founder. And this is what I'm talking about when I say this is unique. We've tasted a lot of coffee companies which have a very close relationship to the farmers, and you know, I mean, it's almost as if they're family. They visit them all the time. They eat together. They visit each other's countries. A lot of this goes on. They have really close relationships with farmers. But this founder is actually this I believe the son of the people from the farm in Colombia that grows this coffee. So when you talk about a coffee roaster that has a close relationship with the farmer, it really doesn't get closer than that. It's really, really neat what they're doing. Native Root Coffee is what we're looking at today. And so...
is that the name of it?
Yeah, oh, Native cool. Root. Native cool. NativeRootCoffee.com is where you can find more about them. They have a subscription service. They've got an app that you can use to pick your favorite coffee. They've got a really cool device, a very short survey that helps you find the kind of coffee you like. And it was funny because I was perusing through their coffees and I saw one right off the bat without even reading very much about it. And I was like, ooh, I bet that one would be my favorite. Mm. And then I took the survey and then that one turned out to be my recommended one.
I
want to
take the
one.
Survey.
Yeah, you should. Anyway, so we're going to get tasting here. They gave us a sample pack of four different coffees. Two of them are signature blends, so they always have those ones. And those are kind of like if someone wants a very predictable, you know, this is what I drink every single day of the year, then there are two that would be really good for that. But for someone more like myself, who, if you listen to the show, I really like weird stuff, interesting, kind of unpredictable, like, oh, I've never tasted that in coffee before. They've got a couple of limited edition coffees, too, and they sent us their two current coffees from those two.
Do these have tasting notes?
They do, okay, on the bags.
I won't look at the bags.
So we have these sampler bags, so I'm not able to speak to... Usually we talk about, like, the retail appearance, so we're not... I'm going to talk about the retail side of it in a little more, which is very exciting, but so we're just... We're looking at four sampler bags. Elderstone and Ember River are the two signature blends. And then the limited edition are Bourbon Yellow Honey and Tabby Yellow Honey. So let's get tasting. Whatever we like the most, we'll drink for the rest of the episode. If we both like the same one, then you can have the one that you like more. So,
that's so sweet.
I'm going to try the bourbon yellow honey because that one was the one that I my test showed me.
That sounds like one that you would really like.
But go for whatever you feel like. Okay. These are the two signatures and these are the two
limited
editions.
All right, I'm going to try the other honey one.
Okay. Okay, first. Here we go.
Okay.
Here we go. Cheers.
Right, cheers.
We are about to taste these coffees from Native Root Coffee. Okay. Here we go. Well, I can't imagine liking a coffee better than this one.
I like this
really
one a lot.
Good.
Yeah.
Tell me what, so on the show here, in case you've forgotten, in case I've forgotten, what we do is Alexi tastes something. And then tries to guess what she's tasting. And I look at the flavor notes, if there are any, which there are on this one. And I tell her whether she's right or wrong.
Oh, I just got it.
That was funny. Ooh.
I gotta
it's like
that.
A favor just punched you in the tongue.
All right. I'm going to say.
So you are drinking right now the Tabi Yellow Honey.
Yeah.
And what do you think the flavor notes are on that?
Is honey one? Okay, that's not what I was going to say, though.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to say butter and, like, some kind of fruit, like some sort of citrus fruit.
Oh, nice. Yellow fruits.
All right.
So you're right. And green apple. Those are two of the tasting notes.
Okay.
Which apples are sometimes yellowish green.
Yeah.
You know? The other flavor note is caramel. So which... oh, really? You actually had that in your mind?
Caramel
is fried butter, basically.
I almost said caramel corn. But I've said that before, and then it's always been like, haha, you're wrong.
Yeah, right.
But I was going to say that.
Oh, my goodness.
I think my...
This is like the first time that you've really honed in. I think you should drink this coffee regularly from now on.
Yeah, I really like it. It's really good.
Yeah, so let's switch with the limited edition here. I'm going to try Tabi Yellow, and you're going to try Bourbon Yellow.
Should I try to guess the tasting notes on this one? Or do we know?
Yeah, go ahead and try to. Yeah. Oh man, I really like this one too. It is, it's darker than the one I was drinking. But yeah, try to guess what the bourbon yellow honey tastes like. Mm. By the way, these just on a basic standard level of measuring, these are both very, very good coffees.
This is really good too.
Very, very low bitterness. A lot of interesting flavors. Very as I was brewing them, when you're brewing, you can tell by the way that the creme kind of comes out of the grounds, whether it's fresh or not, and these were roasted within the last week, so they're very fresh.
This is really good.
What are you tasting?
This one tastes a little like brighter.
Okay.
Maybe.
I wouldn't have tasted any of these because I just tasted that one. But what do you think?
I feel like this is similar to the last one.
Really? I didn't think they were close, really.
This one almost tastes like a little more citrusy, almost.
That's wrong. No, the notes on this one that they give are vanilla, almonds, and jasmine.
So I was like really off on this one. It's really good, though.
A little bit, but I mean, as I always like to tell people on the show, it is what you taste.
Sure.
So flavor notes are just like a guide in case you're kind of wondering what it... Because sometimes, I remember I worked at a restaurant one time and we were doing... it was really cool, actually. I worked at the Weber Grill restaurant. I may have talked about this before on the podcast, but it was a really interesting thing because they put a lot of time into every server that worked there. It was really neat what they did because, I mean, a lot... Like, they trained us for a week.
Yeah.
No following. I spent 40 hours in a training class.
And, oh, wow.
And it was... I mean, it was all about the details about how to present yourself to a table, how to talk about the menu. Anyway, one time, this wasn't even the training. This was just a normal pre-shift meeting, like a long one. They had these cups, styrofoam cups with a hole punched in the top and different things like ginger almonds are hard to smell, but oranges and apples. And it was so funny. Like I would smell something and I'd be like, I know what this is, but I can't see it. So right. I don't like, and so the tasting can be like that. You taste coffee and there is this interesting stuff going on and you do taste it because your palate is, receptors are receiving it. But unless you had just had an almond bar or just had, or you had something to look at. And I think that's the value of tasting notes is that it just gives you some kind of guide. Like, oh, right. Okay, yeah. Like a lot of people who are very educated on coffee tasting tasted this. So that's one thing that that's probably in the milieu of flavors. So that's just the limited edition. Let's go to the signature blends. I will have the Elder Stone. You can try the Ember River.
Okay.
And here we go again. Here we go. I really like that. These are both definitely a little darker than the limited. So limited edition ones were both on the medium to light roast side, and these ones are kind of between medium and dark roast. So a little longer time in the roaster. Again, very smooth. I'm having the Elder Stone. The flavor notes on this one are caramel, red fruits, and almonds. Mm. And I really like it a lot.
What about this one?
Yours is hazelnut, cherry, and raw sugar cane.
Ooh, yeah. I like this one a lot.
Yeah, can I taste it?
Yeah, I'm going to try that.
Yeah, all right. I had a lot to choose from. A whole smorgasbord of coffee. Oh man, this is just, this is like first thing in the morning, like a great.
Yeah.
I love that.
And you said these are darker roast, right?
Yeah, they both are, yeah.
They're really good. Man, so which one's your favorite?
The favorite, I think my favorite was the first one I tried, the bourbon yellow honey.
That's this one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all extremely good. Yeah. That one is my favorite. Mm-hmm. They're all freshly roasted. So, really, really good coffees. The mission of Native Root Coffee, connecting craft coffee lovers to Colombian coffee farmers. That's the other interesting thing other than the fact that there's such a close family relationship with the farmers and then this guy, Erfin, who's going and, you know, like bringing this coffee like all around the world. But I told Ben this when he first contacted me. I said I really like how that just the focus on one country, because there is so much coffee and you can get it from so many places and it can kind of be overwhelming. Like where is this from? If you're drinking Native Root coffee, you know it comes from Colombia, from one family's general estate, and it's supporting the like local economy there by you know bringing. Income in through coffee. They have a sort of a hashtag they use sometimes, or like a motto of paying 10% more, trying to increase the amount of money that the farmers are making, and also acknowledging the value of dignity and recognition. So yeah, people like being paid more for their work, but they also like recognition. So anytime you see a bag of coffee, you'll see the face of one of the people in Colombia on a farm who farmed your coffee, which is really obviously really neat and takes a lot of work and intentionality. It's easy to just kind of like make some sort of a logo in Photoshop and just slap it on every bag, but really like going through and saying, okay, where's this coffee from? Who are we going to, let's get a really high quality picture of this person. Let's put it on the front, you know, like something that really makes people, you know, specialty coffee connoisseurs feel very connected to the place that the coffee comes from. And I've talked about that a lot on this podcast, so I'm not going to tell any of my old stories again. But I love that they do that, and it really gives some proper recognition to people.
Who
otherwise, you know, it's just like you don't think about it. And so many things, you know, the clothes we wear, the orange juice we drink, like where did this come from? We kind of like it's easy to not think about it, but when you see a face, a human face on a bag, you kind of, at least a lot of people will be like, huh, Right. What's the story here? And there is a story to be told.
Yeah, that's very cool.
The last thing I will say before we get to the crime is that a lot of the coffees that we've had are either through subscriptions or, you know, where we live in the Quad Cities, there's a few places, and in a future episode, we're going to talk about this, but there are a few places where you can actually get this high quality specialty coffee at a coffee shop. But, and I kind of lament, sometimes I lament the fact that our very first episode was a bag of coffee that I got from Hy-Vee that did not have the roast date on it and that did not, well, I just didn't like it. And I kind of gave, I feel like I sort of gave our podcast a bad rap by doing that because like a lot, like that is, you know, most people when
it was our first episode.
Yeah. I didn't research. So it was Stumptown Coffee. I think they had just made, which is a great coffee roaster, a really, really great. But I think for whatever reason, it had been sitting on the shelf for a long time and it just didn't taste good. And I got it at the grocery store and it was, it was during the pandemic. And so all these coffee shops were closed.
Right.
They were closed. Like a lot of them at this point in March weren't even doing.
Well, yeah, because this was like in the height of
everything. No one was going outside and going to
all we had was old coffee on Hy-Vee. Old. I mean, everything was picked over even at the grocery store.
I'm now realizing that's why I was cornered into that situation. So that was kind of and I feel like a lot of people who probably, find out about our podcast peripherally and just give it a try are like, why doesn't this guy pick a coffee that he wanted? Anyway, my whole reason for saying that is, wouldn't it be nice if you could get a coffee like this at Hy-Vee? Guess what? You can.
What?
They just started distributing in the Milan, Illinois Hy-Vee with plans to soon have coffee in Bettendorf, the Davenport location at Kimberly, nice. And eventually Iowa City and Coralville. So these guys are very serious about getting the coffee. And which is so good because, I mean, like, I
wonder why they chose Milan as the first one.
It might have been that Milan chose them.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I know all the stores have different managers, and
they get it from different places.
It's difficult to get something in a store like Hy-Vee that has so much. So much going on.
Sure.
But the thing I actually like about Hy-Vee is that you can do that. I know several other local people who make certain food items. And as long as you have the right certification and everything, they will feature some local things, soap and bread and honey and all this stuff. So it's, you know, it's going to be out of the way for a lot of people to go to such and such a tiny little coffee shop on the corner of, you know, some place where they never go, but a lot of people in the Quad Cities are going to Hy-Vee at some point in their week. I mean, it's pretty common.
I mean, I probably go to Hy-Vee like 4 times a week.
You go there a lot. I think I go there a lot too. It's very convenient. We live very close to it. And so I love that they're really making that effort to get their coffee right in front of people. And I just want to tell anyone who's listening, especially who lives close to a Hy-Vee, like, definitely consider this as an alternative to your, because there's a lot of coffee at Hy-Vee.
Yeah.
And even the generic kind of Hy-Vee brand coffee that Hy-Vee makes is not bad. We drink that sometimes. But if you want something that's like a way, like a big quality jump up from that, that's supporting, local farmers in Colombia, please, check out this native root coffee at, I guess I could say coming to a Hy-Vee near you, because it's really good stuff. It's, it just seems like all the people, all these guys who are part of the company are very excited and very like motivated to grow it and put it out there. So, very exciting coffee in a lot of ways. And just at the end of the day, it tastes really good, which is to me, one of the most important things.
Definitely. Definitely.
So thank you to Ben.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
The whole
team. Are, like, all these are really, really good.
Yeah, no, I would drink any one of them at any time.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's get to the crime.
All right.
Is this a Colombian-themed crime?
You know, I was just thinking I should have done a Colombian crime. But, so recently we started watching a show.
Yes.
On, is it Netflix?
Yes.
Called The Chestnut Man, that Ernesto told us about.
Mm-hmm.
So I started thinking we should do a Danish crime.
Whoa.
Yeah, because the show, it's a Danish like crime show.
Yeah.
And it's so far it's really good. We're only a couple episodes in.
Yeah. So there are crimes in Denmark, like real ones?
Yeah. Oh, well, okay. Sort of.
One thing I wanted to mention too, in the founder's biography, it said he was born in Colombia, but then he studied in Norway. And I would actually love to see a much longer bio on him, because Norway is a very coffee-loving country. And I just wonder if that's sort of where he... I wonder if it could be not true, but I wonder if that's where he sort of realized, like, wow, like specialty coffee is a big thing. And I come from, and so what an interesting thing that would be to be born in a country that produces so much coffee, and then to study in a country that doesn't grow any coffee, but appreciates coffee. And then your family works at a coffee farm. And it's like, wow. Like, I don't know if that's the story.
Well, maybe we could find out more.
Yeah. I would love to.
That's interesting.
So, but we are in a different part of Scandinavia today.
And we're going to talk about Mordor,
which is murder.
I think it's murderer, isn't it?
I don't know.
There was a scene in the show. This isn't really giving anything away,
right?
But because the show is actually in Danish, but it has like English like overdub or whatever. Yeah. But there's a scene where somebody painted on a car Mordor, and then Mordor. I think underneath where it says, you know, it said murderer. But it's funny.
Mordor.
But it's funny because they're speaking in English and they're like, why did somebody write this on the car?
Yeah.
So it's funny because it's in, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Okay. So today we're going to be talking about Peter London.
Okay.
All right, here we go. This is the first crime in a while.
Hopefully. You're doing great so far.
Thank you. All right. So Peter London was born on February 15th, 1972, in Roskilde on the Danish island of Zealand.
Oh, they have a big music festival there.
Oh, really? Well, I never heard of that.
I don't know if they have since the pandemic, right. But yeah, it's a huge, huge thing.
Nice. Yeah. I had no idea anything about this area. It is about like an hour southwest of Copenhagen. Okay.
Okay.
I think that's right. You never like went there when you were in Denmark the first time?
No.
Okay. All right. So Peter's mother, Anna, was originally from Germany, which is where his parents met. His father, Ole, had moved to the United States in 1950 with his brother to join the U.S. Army. His brother was stationed in Korea, where he later died of an illness, but Ole was stationed in Germany, where he met Anna. The two got married and eventually moved back to Ole's homeland, Denmark. Several years later, in 1972, Peter was born. So as a young child, Peter's father worked as a bricklayer, and he made a good living. I think bricklayers make pretty good money.
My grandpa was
a bricklayer. Oh, that's right. Yeah, he was.
Back then, I don't know if they did. Now they do.
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought it'd be fun to be a bricklayer.
It's really hard work.
Putting that sauce on the bricks.
You're just like under the sun. Putting that sauce.
Is that cement?
You would have been a great bricklayer.
But anyway, yeah, so he made a good living. They lived in a beautiful home. However, they were not without struggles. So Anna and Ole both were heavy drinkers. And in 1979, Ole developed a blood clot, which made working as a bricklayer very impossible. And the family soon fell on hard times financially.
Yeah.
So eventually they went bankrupt and lost their house in 1980. Ole had some relatives who lived in the U.S., and soon they decided to move to the United States in search of more opportunity. So they soon settled in Ormond Beach, Florida, which set Peter on a path to one day be a Florida man.
Oh, wow.
And we all know what that means.
Yeah.
So upon moving to Florida, his parents found work running a beachside motel. I don't think they owned the motel. I think they just ran it. I can't imagine like having lost everything and then being able to buy a motel. So I'm pretty sure they just ran this motel. But they didn't stay long in Florida. Within a few years, the family had relocated to Maggie Valley, North Carolina. So Peter was a quiet child, but he quickly adapted to the new city and he made friends and was even involved in sports and, you know, like a normal kid.
Yeah.
Peter had a difficult relationship with his mother, though. She still drank heavily and was often putting him down, embarrassing him, and even chased him around with a fly swatter when he had friends over. So that's embarrassing.
Yeah.
Did your mom ever do that to you?
No.
That's no, nice.
She didn't, yeah. I didn't know how lucky I was.
But Peter, you know, he tried to make light of it, you know, kind of acted like, oh, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, laugh it off, blah, blah, blah. So on the other hand, Peter and his father were very close. His father was always kind and loving towards him. Okay. So that was nice.
Yeah.
Although Anna claimed that Ole was not the same towards her, she confided in friends that he was a controlling drunk and that she was afraid of him. So as Peter entered high school, he began to get in fights at school and even have a couple run-ins with the law. And in 1986, Ole left his wife and moved to Los Angeles and took 14-year-old Peter with him, leaving the mom in North Carolina. But L.A. ended up, you know, not being all it was cracked up to be, because just a few weeks later, they moved to New York City and then to Boston shortly after that.
What kicked him out of L.A.?
I think they just didn't like it.
Okay.
But, like, moving is very expensive.
Yeah.
Like, it's expensive to move across town.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't assume this guy was working at this time, so I don't know how he had all this money to just keep bebopping around the United States.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe, and I don't know, like, I don't want to speculate on how he was living his life, but maybe he was involved in some shady stuff.
Some money coming in from some...
Yeah.
The dark web.
Yeah, the dark web. The dark web in, what was this, 1987 or whatever.
Yeah.
They didn't stay in Boston long either, and by the time Peter was... 16, I believe. They ended up back in Florida, where Ole found a job as a bricklayer again in Miami.
Should have just stayed in Florida.
Yeah, I know. And after Ole and Anna's year-long separation, they finally reunited and decided to give their marriage another chance.
Oh, nice.
So that's good.
Yeah.
That's good.
I think it is. Your face is telling me a different story.
So Peter was a reasonably bright kid, but at this point he hated school and had begun running with a bad crowd. He started experimenting with cocaine, probably wasn't super hard to get that in Miami, and marijuana, and in 1988, he dropped out of high school.
Okay.
So it wasn't all bad, though. You know, he wasn't a total deadbeat. He ended up getting a job as a bricklayer with his father, so he was, like, trying to learn the trade and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is nice. But what do you think the family did next? What does this family love to do?
Move.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they moved back to North Carolina.
Huh.
So I don't know if this was to, like, get Peter away from the drug scene in Miami,
right.
Or I don't know. But they moved back there. Peter started going to school again, but he didn't leave his ways behind him because he started selling drugs. In North Carolina. So he's still on this, you know, naughty path. So over the next few years, things continued to get worse. Peter was still dabbling in drugs and binging on alcohol on a regular basis. His father was often drunk and abusive towards his mother, and he began to exhibit the same behavior, often lashing out at his mother when he was drunk. It became so explosive that the police were even called a few times.
Mm-hmm.
So things are not going great at the London household.
Yeah.
So on the evening of April 1st, 1991, Peter and his mother got into an argument over the length of Peter's hair. So she thought it was too long, but he was going for the grunge style that was popular in the early 90s.
Sure, yeah.
You know, he wanted to look like Nirvana or whatever.
Yeah.
And the argument turned deadly and resulted in Peter strangling his mother.
To death?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah. So after the murder, Peter's father quickly jumped in to help his son, and they loaded Anna's body into the car.
And helped him?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he always had his back.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
They drove it to Cape Hatteras, where they buried it on a beach, vowing not to speak of it again.
Wow, that was easy.
Yeah, no kidding. Man, within the months following Anna's death, Peter and his father moved to Canada to leave the past behind them and start a new life.
And the body.
Leave the past and the body behind them.
Yeah.
But on November 1st, 1991, exactly 7 months after the murder, a couple was out for a nice walk on the beach and stumbled upon a body wrapped in plastic wrap and obviously called the police.
I'm guessing burying a body on the beach is kind of like the don't do that list for murders, like 101.
Well, yeah, it seems like that would very easily,
it's going,
like,
to be like some dog is going to dig it up, or the, or like sand, the water is slowly going to wash
away.
Yeah, on a beach. That sounds again, we never like to
give people tips
on how to murder and
how to hide bodies. Yeah, but yeah, you're right. Yeah. When I read that, I was like, that seems like a really
a forest. Stupid, I think,
yeah, forest, the woods, like
yes,
or maybe the if they had, like yeah, maybe if they had like dumped the body off a boat in the ocean.
Yeah, because in the water, as we learned with the Peter Clint case,
right?
Peter Clint, was that his name? Clint.
No. Shoot, what was his name?
Anyway, this
yeah.
Chiropractor from around here, one of the reasons that it was so hard for them to identify anything about the body is because it had been in the water in the Mississippi River for a month and, right. and all of the
identifying.
Not having the DNA now, but I mean, they just couldn't tell. Right. Like, they just knew it was a body and that's all they knew. So anyway, so
we should write a book about this.
Yeah. Anyway, so they left the past behind them.
So the body was identified as Anna London, and the obvious suspects were Anna's husband and son, who were now missing.
Yeah.
So this began a 7-month manhunt for the two, eventually leading police to a hotel room in Toronto in June of 1992. Hmm. The two were arrested and brought back to North Carolina to stand trial. So
how'd they find them?
You know, I don't know. It's
back
not
then,
really clear.
It's not like emails,
I'm assuming maybe talking to people, maybe
yeah.
family members that
it's
they
good
might
detective
have
work.
Caught, you know, been yeah. in touch with or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah. Okay. But it took them a while to find them.
Yeah.
So at the trial they argued that Anna's death had been an accident. Peter claimed that his mother attacked him and he pushed her in self-defense and then she fell and broke her neck.
Hmm. I'm assuming by the 90s they have the ability to tell that that's not true in the autopsy,
yeah.
or is the body too rotted?
I mean, I think the body was pretty decomposed at this
yeah.
time, but I think that story is just kind of like,
yeah.
that doesn't happen.
Yeah, a refrigerator fell on her.
Right. So the court was not buying it, as mm-hmm. you can imagine. And 1 year later, in July of 1993, at the age of 21, Peter was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Mm. His father, Ole, was charged as an accomplice and given a 2-year sentence. Hmm. And as part of their sentencing, the pair was to be deported back to Denmark once they had served their time.
Okay.
So just a year into Peter's prison sentence, he was contacted by a Danish TV program called The American Dream about young Danish people who were living in America.
Clearly they did not do their research.
I guess, you know, kind of giving different perspectives of lots of different lifestyles.
Did they know he was a murderer?
Yeah, they had
okay.
heard about
okay.
it. And I think it was kind of a big story there because he was from Denmark.
Oh, okay.
And people probably just
the
wanted
American
to know.
Dream.
Living, yeah. He was living the American dream. Yeah, yeah. They wanted to interview him, you know, and put him on the show. And he gladly accepted.
Yeah.
He was pretty psyched about it. So when they came to the Brown Creek Correctional Institution to interview him, he had painted half his face white and half of it black to represent the good and evil which lived within him.
Wow.
He referred to himself as both vicious and delicious, which I think should be the title of your next album.
I'll see what I can do.
Lewis Knudsen, vicious and delicious. He recited poetry for them, played guitar, and lifted weights for the cameras.
This is like TV gold.
He also said that the hardest thing about being in prison was that he didn't have a girlfriend. So being a very handsome young Danish man, this prompted many women to write to him after the program aired that December. You know, plus he had this kind of like cute southern accent because he lived in the South.
Okay.
You know,
so it was an very interesting accent,
yeah,
I suppose. Yeah.
So, you know, he was very handsome.
Okay.
Yeah. Charming.
Yeah.
You know, I might write to him. So one of the women, a Danish woman named Tina, struck up a very special connection with Peter through their letters.
Danish-American or just Danish?
No, she was Danish, so
okay.
she was living in Denmark.
So she found out about him from Denmark?
Well, the show aired in Denmark.
Oh, it only aired? Okay, it was
yeah,
a Danish show.
Yeah, it was
show.
A Danish show.
Okay,
yeah.
That makes a lot more
yeah,
sense. I'm
so,
like, why are Americans like running around? Okay.
No, so she saw this, you know, guy
yeah.
and was like, oh, yeah. I'm going to write to him. So during his time in prison, Peter also wrote many letters and journal entries of his own with a common theme that he needed to get out so that he could kill again.
Just kill anyone?
Yeah. So at the time, it was unclear whether it was, you know, he was serious or he was doing it for attention.
Yeah.
One of his letters said, "I've been in jail for a long time now. If I brutally murdered a lot of people when I get out, I would have a pretty good reason. And believe it or not, I find murder to be very, very, very delicious."
Ooh, this guy disturbs me with his love of the word delicious, among other things. So he journaled this, but no one knew.
Well, he like wrote letters to like family members and stuff, like telling them.
And said this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't that really hurt his chances of ever getting out of jail?
Well, one would think.
Yeah.
One would think. But over the next few years, Peter tried to appeal his conviction and length of his sentence. But his appeals were denied. But however, in 1995, his sentence was reduced to 15 years.
Hmm.
But the following, well, actually, hang on. Sorry, I'm getting a little ahead of myself.
That's okay.
The following year, in 1996, Peter and his girlfriend, Tina, ended up getting married while Peter was incarcerated. So I don't know exactly how that worked. I've heard of people doing that in prison.
I would be interested to
I'm
see.
I'm assuming she came to the U.S. and went to the prison and they had a little ceremony.
Yeah. Okay.
So anyway, so they get married. And then in 1999, due to prison overcrowding, Peter was granted early release. At the age of 27.
Someone who has written his family members how much he would love to kill.
Oh, and I forgot to mention too. So when this thing aired and this show aired in Denmark, there was a kind of like a well-known psychiatrist, a Swedish psychiatrist. His name was Sten Levander. While he was watching the show, he used this thing called the psychopathy checklist to kind of rate, like, I guess it's like a way to determine if someone's a psychopath.
Yeah.
And here, I have it here. So I'll give you reference. So you get, like, the most you can get is 40 points.
Okay.
So Eileen Wuornos, who is a female serial killer, I'm sure you've heard of. No.
I haven't, but okay. I mean, I don't know anything.
No,
about
that's
Syria.
Okay. She killed like a bunch of men. She was a prostitute.
Okay.
So she scored 32 out of 40.
Okay.
Paul Bernardo, who was a Canadian serial killer with his wife, they killed like a bunch of young girls. This was like in the early 90s.
Wow.
He scored a 35 out of 40. And Peter received a 39 out of 40, which is the same as Ted Bundy.
Wow.
And they let this guy out of prison.
Oh, my goodness.
Like, basically,
listen to
like
the
13 years early.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was released and sent back to Denmark, where he moved in with his wife, Tina, and her teenage daughter.
Oh, no.
So did Peter and his new family live happily ever after, or did he make good on his promise and kill again?
You are not going to do this to me.
We will find out next time.
Oh, you're terrible.
It's a surprise. It's a part two episode. And I promise we will not wait like 2 months.
I have another coffee for us to do soon.
Okay.
And we will try
we'll
to do it within
like
the next week.
Yeah, within the week.
Yeah, we should be able to do that. All right, everyone. I'm just as disappointed as all you are because I did not know what was going to happen. But at the same time, I'm on the edge of my seat and I am very much looking forward to hearing in real time what happened once Peter got back to Denmark.
Mm-hmm.
This has been Coffee with Crime. Thank you to Ben Herman for reaching out and the whole team at Native Root Coffee. Please check out Native Root Coffee in the coffee section of the Milan Hy-Vee if you live in the Quad Cities, coming soon to different locations. You can tell what it is by the kind of light brown paper bag style coffee bag with a face of a coffee farmer on the front of it. And
I really want to see the bags.
You go to Hy-Vee all the time.
You will
see them. So this has been Coffee with Crime, and I'm Lewis
and I'm Alexi,
and we'll take our coffee
with crime.